Thank you, Dr. Preuss, for that very kind introduction. Reverend and dear colleague and dear friend, I'm not going to read all these books to you, but I do want to have them at hand for purposes of citation now and again. The topic, as I've finally formulated it, is the two realms today, civic and spiritual upheaval. One need not be a seer to realize that the vexing economic, political, and cultural conflicts of our time signal a much deeper crisis. It is the moral, philosophical, and religious underpinning of our civilization, which are crumbling before our very eyes. Small wonder, then, that the whole superstructure shuddered with what may well turn out to be the terminal convulsions of irreversible decomposition. Many Christians everywhere see the gravity of the situation, are deeply distressed by it, but do not quite know what they can or ought to do about it. For the Neros of the temporal order seem in the main to be fiddling, while the trendy set among church leaders are actually pouring fuel into the fire, gleefully. The average layman finds this revolutionary lunacy among the clergy incomprehensible and infuriating. Mr. Malcolm Muggeridge speaks for millions when he writes of this new breed of clerics as follows. My own feelings about them were crystallized in Moscow in the early 30s when I had occasion to show one of them round an anti-God museum. As we moved from one exhibit to another, pausing before the books displayed, long enough for their blasphemous titles to be translated, I wondered when a sense of shock or disapproval would register on his amiable countenance. It never did. With his broad expanse of clerical collar shining in the late autumn sunshine, he departed even more cheerfully than he came. In the light of this and other like experiences, I have come to regard clerical Christianity and its officers as totally farcical. As Kierkegaard puts it, a folding screen behind which the Christian evades the real strenuousness of being a Christian. So far, Malcolm Muggeridge. If we modern Christians are to respond in any principled, coherent sort of way to the multi-level challenges of our time, we need above all to be clear about the classic and biblical distinction between churchly and civic spheres, powers and functions. Where these two spheres are confused and misconstrued, the result is bound to be serious mischief and damage to both. The remainder of this paper, therefore, will attempt to show the crucial importance and relevance of the two realms doctrine for our modern situation. The treatment of so vast a subject naturally requires considerable selection and exclusion, the felicity of which will no doubt be judged variously. The argument will proceed through the following four stages. One, opposition to the two kingdom doctrine in modern Lutheranism. Two, natural law or social gospel. Three, the real trouble, secularist elimination of natural religion from public life and of revealed religion from the church. Finally, four, a positive suggestion, not secular ecumenism, but civic ecumenism. Number one, opposition to the two kingdom doctrine in modern Lutheranism. At the risk of oversimplification, the relevant teaching of the Book of Concord, contained mainly in Article 7, 8, 16 and 28 of the Augsburg Confession and of the Apology, and in Luther's Catechism, may be summed up for our purposes about as follows. God rules in the world in two fundamentally different ways. He has established civic, temporal, political authority to protect man's earthly bodily welfare, and the church to distribute the eternal heavenly treasures of forgiveness and salvation in Christ. These spiritual treasures are offered only in the gospel, including the sacraments, and cannot be gained in any other way, for example, through law, reason, outward morality, etc. The alone saving gospel creates and sustains the Christian church, which, as the real kingdom of Christ on earth, is not of this world. It is not a segment of society and does not interfere with ordinary civic affairs any more than it changes the natural orders of day and night or of the season. Civil government, on the other hand, has its own proper sphere and function, being guided not by the gospel, but by natural law and natural human reason, which even after the fall can manage earthly affairs tolerably well. Clearing up two misunderstandings will round out the picture. In the first place, it is important to note that the distinction between the civic and spiritual spheres is not the same as that between God's kingdom and Satan's rule over the earth, as, for example, found in St. Augustine, the city of God. Christians do not belong, one of the kingdoms collapsing there, dramatically. Christians do not belong to the world or to the devil's kingdom, but they do live also in the civic sphere and have obligations there, including the duty of obedience to lawful authority, Romans 13, except when commanded to sin, as we find in Acts. And of course, civil government has the power of the sword, that is, the right and duty to protect its subjects by the use of force, including capital punishment and defensive war. Secondly, the distinction, which incidentally is not exclusively Lutheran, between the two realms, Calvin, for example, writes much more soberly about it than many of his contemporary followers. And it's interesting that the Article 16 of the Apology is able to say that the opponents raise accept Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession without any question. The applications, of course, are something else. So this distinction is not at all the same thing as the customary modern legal doctrine of the wall of absolute separation between church and state. Thus, the theological doctrine maintains, for instance, the right and duty of the church's public teachers to instruct Christians about their Christian obligations, whether as rulers or as rulers. The modern political doctrine, on the other hand, tends to resent this as a violation of the principle of church-state separation. This whole traditional scheme outlined here is no longer acceptable to many within nominal Lutheranism. And here I'm not going to weary you with endless citations, but I merely want to show and highly recommend as a reference book this book by Karl Hirst, Two Kingdoms and One World, which contains pretty well a record of the current discussion and a reflection of it in various social and political pronouncements of modern church bodies. And it refers to a much more substantial bit of work done in Germany, where a number, I think three volumes, have been published on this very thing, and where this discussion has been very, very intense. There is also a volume here, edited by Günther Wolf, Luther und die Obrigkeit, a very important collection of essays on this very thing, where one can see the clashing of contradictory opinions. What I want to point out, however, is that some leading Wittist theologians, especially in American Lutheranism, such as Brassen, for example, really have very serious criticisms of the Two Kingdom doctrine, and one of these criticisms is that in the nature of the case, the distinction of between the two kingdoms or two realms tends to make it a first and second class affair and to depress the importance of the secular kingdom. And that he resents mainly in the interest of his overpowering revolutionary itch, which is documented on many pages in this book and also elsewhere. For example, how can one harmonize with the Lutheran doctrine of the distinction of the two kingdoms? This statement by the same Brassen in a chapter entitled Apocalyptic Theology of Revolution. He says, our society is on the brink of becoming a police state. He is talking not about the Soviet Union, which couldn't bother him less, but about America, by the way. Our society is on the brink of becoming a police state. There are secret files on people who sing freedom songs and carry peace signs. But Christianity is a conspiracy for freedom. Its missionaries must cross state lines to spread the gospel of being free. Now, I would submit that this kind of thinking has absolutely nothing to do with any Lutheran distinction of the two realms, and in fact is a complete redefinition of the gospel as a kind of political good cheer, or at least as including a large portion of a political revolutionary kind of virus. You find the same thing, and in rather potent form, in another highly significant book, The Church Emerging, a U.S. Lutheran case study edited by Roiman. He himself, in the editorial remarks, seems appalled by the direction of some of the contributions, which seem quite irresponsible. But also the direction here is a strong opposition and a complete disrespect to any kind of Lutheran understanding of the distinction of the two spheres, and again, a revolutionary fever that identifies the gospel, for example, even with such things as Mao Zedong's rule in Red China. And this is somehow supposed to be part of the good news as well. So the whole thing borders really heavily on lunacy. Now, we come to the second section, entitled Natural Law or Social Gospel. The main reason for the objection to the two-realm scheme seems to be the feeling that the Christian's social and political responsibilities are shortchanged by this arrangement or approach. After the Second World War, particularly, when so much of theological discussion was under the spell of Karl Barth, this Reformed thinker exercised a tremendous influence also on Lutherans in the matter of the two realms. Barth, with his Reformed Christocratic approach, felt that the Lutheran distinction of realms had emancipated the state into a lawless and arbitrary autonomy of which Hitler's totalitarianism was but the natural and logical outcome. Let us hear William Barclay echo this criticism rather forcefully in his little book, Ethics in a Permissive Society. That's what he says about Luther now. Luther's teaching leaves the impression that in the secular realm the government is supreme, and that from it and not from Christ the Christian must take his duty. And it is this very fact which allowed Hitler to come to power and begat Belsen and Dachau. The Lutheran Church did not stand out, for it was conditioned to accept the civil power. It might not be too much to say, he continues, that Luther's ethic of church and state was the greatest disaster in all the history of ethics, for it opened the way for a kind of Christianity which allowed the state to do terrible things and in too many cases made no protest. It is impossible to divide life into spheres like that. Now it seems to me that there are at least two minor points and one major one which ought to be urged against this sort of argumentation. The minor points are, one, that the civic duties of individual Christians, according to their station in life, are not at all the same thing as the assumption of civic duties by the church as church. In other words, that Christians have civic duties doesn't mean that the church has civic duties. Two, the reason for the relative subservience of the official church under Hitler may well lie not in even a misunderstood two-realm doctrine, but in the systematic destruction of the church's confessional integrity by over a century of rationalistic pseudo-theology at the university. The major point to be made, however, is that a proper understanding and application of natural law would have been perfectly adequate as a weapon against Hitler and Hitlerism. Of course, when natural law had been undermined and virtually banished by the pseudo-scientific mythology of Darwinism, which inspired both National Socialism and Marxist International Socialism, when further, the demons of nationalism had taken over the vacuum left by the insipid religion pervaded by the tottering facades of the Constantinian church establishment, what else could then be expected but a public morality of the most weak-kneed and spineless kind? Or are we to believe that those who no longer had any regard for natural law might still be expected to honor the gospel In any case, how concretely would one have gone about resisting Hitler with the gospel, apart from direct doctrinal issues in the church struggle? Barclay suggests that vexing modern problems like racialism can be solved only with the gospel, not with the law. Then he formulates the horrendous sentence, "The social gospel is not an addendum to the gospel, it is the gospel." The social gospel is the gospel. Page 193 of that little book. We have here the reformed Barthian confusion of law and gospel. What this must finally mean is that there is no such thing as real gospel at all. Rather, the so-called gospel is simply another form of law. This, however, is to attack not some Lutheran peculiarity or speciality, but the heart of the New Testament itself. The strict demands of God in his law and the free gift of life and salvation in the gospel of Christ are two entirely different, indeed opposite things. To turn them into alternative versions of the same thing is to destroy the Christian gospel in principle. It is important, however, to oppose the social gospel in the right way and for the right reason. F.H. Closter's paper, entitled Kingdom and Church, A Biblical Reexamination of the Calvinistic Perspective, given at a recent Evangelical Theological Society meeting, made the startling point that Walter Rauschenbusch's social gospel was deplorable, not because it was social gospel, but because it was the wrong kind of social gospel. And so he kind of ruined the image for the whole thing. At a less theological level, many people pragmatically reject the leftist social gospel, which is simply a religiously flavored socialism, Marxist or Fabian, but then seem quite happy to have the church propound a kind of rightist, conservative gospel, social gospel. Consider, for example, the very name of the publication Christian Economics, very popular among many conservatives. How can there be such a thing as Christian economics? Economic policies or systems could be just or unjust, realistic or unrealistic, workable or unworkable, but how could they possibly be Christian? The fact is that the New Testament, not to speak of the gospel in the strict sense, lays down no social or economic or political program of any kind for the ordering of temporal society. That is left to the civic sphere, where, of course, Christians do participate according to their light and to their station in life, serving their neighbors in love. But does economics or politics become Christian merely because Christians are involved, or perhaps even in charge? If so, then there must be such a thing as Christian banking, Christian farming, Christian fertilizing, Christian milking, Christian mechanics, Christian electronics, mathematics, etc., etc., ad absurdum. There simply is no social gospel, neither liberal nor conservative. And the church as church has no mandate whatever to prescribe the social and political arrangements of civil society. That must be left to natural law, common sense, reason, conscience, etc., although the presence of a large proportion of Christian citizens imbued with love for God and neighbor are of course bound to make a tremendous difference to the functioning of society at every level. Thirdly, I come now to the main point. The Lutheran confessions assign temporal government basically to human reason. That also was Luther's view. He writes, and this is a bit of a startling quotation, "God gave reason in order that we might govern bodily things. For bringing up children, for servicing houses, etc., we don't need Holy Scripture. This gift, namely reason, this gift God cast among all nations." We might quibble especially about the bringing up children, because we know very well how Luther said that any school where God's word does not rule, he would not advise anybody to send his children. What he means is a purely natural, the philosophical, the psychological and so on, the mechanics, as it were, of family life. And here too lies a difference between the Lutheran and the Calvinistic view of looking at the thing. Many Calvinistic, even good books on psychology, which rightly attack, for example, the fantasies of Sigmund Freud, and we should go all the way with that, because Freudianism is nothing but a kind of a pagan mythology of a dangerous messianic kind. I like what one British neurologist has said about Freud. He said, the theories of Freud are rather like a bathroom in a house, very valuable on occasion, but not the sort of place to stay all day in. It has partial truths, but it is not the truth. So, when Calvinist psychologists attack Freud, we ought to go with them all the way, and as far as they are Christians attacking paganism. But then there comes a point where these psychologists become particularly Calvinistic. And here, I believe, among conservative Christians and also Lutherans, there is proliferating a great popularity for all sorts of so-called Bible courses and approaches which give the impression that for every social or psychological or personal or family problem, there is a kind of patented spiritual solution which you can get to by finding the right texts in the Bible and then doing accordingly. I suggest that this is quite false. From a Lutheran point of view, the Bible is not a textbook for all sorts of human and social relations. Mind you, there are important directions given. There is a very basic view given of what Christian marriage means, namely the counterpart of the relation between Christ and his church. But there are no mechanical solutions to particular problems as such that by the manipulation of a few texts you could get at. Nor is it right to say that our whole knowledge of human nature must come from the Bible. The Bible does not tell us the cause for drunkenness, for example. And it's overdoing a good thing, and it's a typically Calvinistic thing to expect that the cause for alcoholism will be found in some Bible text. It won't be. The Bible tells us that drunkenness is wrong. It does not give us a psychological explanation of the origin of alcoholism. For that, it's perfectly valid to look and to inspect actual human nature and to approach the thing scientifically. There's a perfectly valid sphere for experimental psychology. And even Scripture says that the things of man knows no one except the spirit of man which is in him. These are not things for which we depend essentially on divine revelation. Though, of course, when it comes to our relation to God, that is given by divine revelation. So that's merely as a kind of little explanation to how Luther meant that. Now, what we see here is Luther's cheerful ability to say all that can be governed by reason and natural law. I suspect that the reason for the widespread loss of enthusiasm for Luther's attitude today is that we see reason today in quite a different light. When Luther said reason is able to do it, he did not mean what today is meant by reason at the average university or high school. When Luther meant human reason, he meant a capacity of the human mind, not mere abstract rationality, not mere computerizing, but he meant a human mind concretely grounded in natural law, grounded in the natural knowledge of God and of his will, which, according to St. Paul, Romans 1 and 2, all men by nature have accessible and have the testimony to in their own heart. So that kind of reason, reason which even after the fall has not a perfect but nevertheless a sufficient inkling of basic decency and of the existence of God, that is the kind of reason that Luther was talking about when he said reason is adequate to organize social life. But today that's no longer what we mean by reason. Today, when people say reason, they mean, since Descartes especially, merely abstract rationality. Abstract rationality. Merely a computer process. It has no value of its own. It's not grounded in anything. It's purely a method. Buckley once said that method is the flesh pot of people who live in metaphysical deserts. There's a tremendous preoccupation with methods and techniques and bags of tricks of all description. Anyhow, for us today, reason has become merely an abstract process that any computer could do. And therefore, what applies to computers applies to that kind of reason. Garbage in, garbage out. The computer is no better than what you put in. And so this kind of reason, as merely abstract rationality, can't come up with any better conclusions than what are fed into it in the first place. But since Luther, a great deal has happened in the history of the Western world. Reason, which at first seemed to hold promise of emancipating man, and, well, it promised great things. Man would now come of age and reclaim his dignity, what has happened? It has ended by falling into a miserable confusion of tongues. Reason has now ended by denying not only God, but finally denying itself. Reason has chopped off the branch on which it was sitting, because even to Darwin the thought occurred, and it disturbed him. If indeed a human being is nothing but an overdeveloped monkey, then what intellectual respect can be accorded that conclusion of the mind by an overdeveloped monkey, that that is indeed what he is? So he's chopped off the branch on which he was sitting. Reason that seemed to be supreme suddenly has questioned itself, like stomach juice when it has nothing else to feed on attacking the stomach and giving us ulcers. So reason has overreached itself and suffered a fatal rupture. And today, therefore, the public are not so disposed to trust reason. And therefore, in fact, we have this tremendous and this frightening phenomenon of unreason. You find unreason, of course, you find marvelous prophecies of it in Dostoevsky already. You find the reality in the screaming thousands in front of Hitler, screaming themselves hoarse, seek higher. You find the same thing under communism, the thought of Mao Zedong and so on. And you find it in Western culture as well. Francis Schaeffer has called it the escape from reason in quite a little classic by that name. So reason, having questioned itself, had no place to go. And now the particular conclusion that people have come to is that reason can't tell us any important things about life. Reason can only tell us relatively unimportant things. How to make hydrochloric acid. Reason is capable of that. But how to bring up your children, whether or not to commit adultery, whether or not it's right to kill unborn babies, what the meaning and purpose of life is, finally reason can't tell us that. And so you have the tremendous spectacle. The great British Huxley family, Thomas Huxley, called Darwin's bulldog. Thomas Huxley, who believed profoundly in the power of human reason, and the whole Huxley family furthered that in the whole English-speaking world. And now in our time, Aldous Huxley, ignominiously having to write in his book that reason, after all, can't provide ultimate reality. The drug experience will reveal ultimate reality. Aldous Huxley came to believe that finally we have to open up to reality in some other way. Maybe some vision, some glimpse of ultimate reality through drugs. Other people prefer sex, some turn to music, some to this and that. Anyway, they're agreed it's not in reason. Well, that is logical at least. Because if reason really is to be accepted in that sense, then that kind of reason can no longer sustain human life, and especially social life. What we have witnessed is the invasion of unreason presented in the name of reason, and what has masqueraded now for 200 years, well, at least 100 years, under the name of science, Darwinian ideas of natural progress by pure chance causes, where there's no prevision, no purpose, no intelligence in the universe, simply blindly evolving forces interacting by the laws of natural selection. This kind of thing has created the ascendancy of a new religion, a very militant religion, which we today call secular humanism, but which is anything but truly humanistic. It is profoundly and fundamentally inhuman and anti-human. For example, when one prominent humanist can write, as he did recently, one of the co-discoverers of the DNA molecule, that children ought not to be declared to be legally alive until about the third or fourth day. Why not? Because some of the defects don't become obvious immediately after birth. Then most of them do become obvious by about the third day. So then if you find the baby is physically gravely defective, has some disease or some grave lack, then, and he is already 3 days old, you haven't issued a certificate of birth, the child is not legally alive, and you just get rid of it, put it in the rubbish bin. That is today proclaimed in the name of humanism. It is, of course, no worse than the slaughter of 1 million unborn human beings that goes on today in this country, especially as a result of the infamous decision in 1973 of the Supreme Court, which in principle declared open season on unborn Americans. No society can hope to survive when the most sacred and fundamental of all human dignities, namely life itself, is denied that severely. Another humanist wrote that we should experiment trying to produce human beings which would be lacking in certain limbs, without certain limbs. Remember the thalidomide tragedy that happened in Western Germany a few years ago? Well, now this scientist was suggesting, in the name of scientific humanism, that we should deliberately try to produce human beings without certain limbs, because they might be very handy for certain purposes. For instance, he said, space crew. If you need a space crew, legs only get in the way. First of all, it takes extra space, which you don't have in a space capsule, and all that extra weight, it requires more precious fuel to shoot you up into outer space. Therefore, it would be very handy to have space crews without legs. All they need is a bit of brains and their hands and fingers to manipulate the knobs, and they certainly don't need legs. Therefore, let's breed babies without legs. Now, this, it calls itself secular humanism. I suggest it is the most inhuman thing, and if this philosophy is allowed to prevail, then it'll undoubtedly spell the end of our civilization as we have known it for roughly now 2,000 years. And then what is in store for us is the kind of hell that they have in Red China, in so-called liberated Vietnam, and in Eastern Europe. The thing to be remembered is that this secular humanism, which is invading our culture like a destructive virus or like a cancer, the thing presents itself in the name of reason, in the name of science. And I believe the churches and church people have too readily abdicated before it, surrendered before it, and said, well, all right, you say that's all science, so we're going to retreat a bit further back. We're going to give up natural law. We're going to give up the idea that everybody by nature can see the existence of God. I guess science can prove to us that you can do no such thing. The result of that is a complete Christian retreat from the public sphere. A retreat which is bound to be dehumanizing and already has been on a tremendous, tremendous worldwide global scale. I have here a most significant article which appeared in the Journal of Church and State earlier this year, a guest editorial entitled Issues That Divide, The Triumph of Secular Humanism, by Leo Pfeffer. Who is Leo Pfeffer? He is one of the leading secular humanists of our time, who is pretty much of a mentor to the United States Supreme Court in its recent decisions over the last few decades regarding church-state relations, regarding the whole function of religion in society. He quite brazenly makes the point and gloats about it that all along, on all the issues that used to concern Christians in public life in America, the secular humanists have won all along the line. The last battle, he says, is the battle of abortion, but even that the church will have to give up on, and they're making one last stand on that, but the church will have to give in and accept also the secular humanist position on abortion. That comes from the pen of one of the leading secular humanist thinkers of our time. If you want to have the shock that one of my students had recently, who didn't believe that secular humanism could be all that bad, read the book that he read. Corliss Lamont, The Philosophy of Humanism. And there you will see what is in store for us and what precisely it means for human existence. How deeply anti-Christian the whole movement is. It is this kind of cancer that we're harboring in our midst. Now, I believe this has deep implications for us as Christians and for us as Christian citizens. Because we've got to realize that we are fighting not some kind of secular science. We are fighting a religion. A religion, secular humanism is a religion, every whit as much as Christianity or Mohammedanism. In fact, the Supreme Court itself, in the Torcaso versus Watkins case in 1961, determined officially that for purposes of public law in America, secular humanism is as much a religion as anything else, therefore entitled to freedom of speech, etc. So, secular humanism, a religious worldview, now seeks to dominate our society, however, not in the name of religion, but it pretends to be objective scholarship, objective science, reason, and so on. Only an interesting thing has happened. what has happened in recent years is that the claims of the whole evolutionary worldview have been challenged. Challenged not by theologians who have forgotten how to challenge anything, but challenged by scientists and philosophers themselves. So that you have the remarkable spectacle that lay scientists, not only without theological backing, but despite theological abuse and obstructions of all kinds, lay scientists have made a tremendous push in this country, claiming that from the point of view of natural reason, from the point of view of an objective observation of the facts, the whole evolutionary philosophy, which is basic to secular humanism, this philosophy simply is not so. It simply does not correspond to observable facts. And increasingly you have people say that the actual facts of the case compel the conclusion that there is a creative intelligence and purpose in the universe. This is not at all a theological consideration. This is a consideration forced on serious thinkers by the facts themselves. One of the people who has most effectively drawn out the implications of this kind of thinking has been a man by the name of Smith, who holds 3 scientific doctorates, is a biochemist, and has written a number of excellent books, one of them being The Creation of Life, A Cybernetic Approach to Evolution. And there he shows that whereas in Darwin's day, when very little was known about the nature of life, the nature of the cell and so on, today, he says, the situation is so different. Today we know, especially in the last 20 years, we have found that life is in fact a vast and incredibly complex information system. And with the development of modern communications techniques and supercomputers, we know now how information behaves, and from a strictly empirical scientific point of view, we can say with absolute assurance that information is known not to arise spontaneously or to be upgraded spontaneously. And if in fact all living things, by virtue of their DNA coding, constitute a vast, incredibly complicated information system, then the only conclusion that is reasonably possible, not theologically, reasonably, philosophically, scientifically, empirically, is that intelligence must be there before life. That life must be, being an information system, must be the result of a pre-existing intelligence. This kind of thinking has been so convincing to so many scientific people that you've had a most remarkable thing taking place in this country. You've had scientific creationism come in more and more, not into parish school or church school, into public school. Recently, last year, a court in Indiana ruled that a certain science textbook was unconstitutional because it referred to creation as well as to evolution and taught a creationist point of view. How, you ask yourself, how could such a decision be made? This is a kind of reversal, a kind of Tennessee monkey trial in reverse. The evolutionists, who are beginning to feel the pinch intellectually, are trying now to use the courts to get the courts to rule that it is unconstitutional to teach anything but evolution in the schools. To show you how religious an issue this is, I have here quite an important and intriguing statement, a statement affirming evolution as a principle of science and deliberately attacking all forms of creationism with considerable vigor. And this appeared in a magazine called The Humanist. The Humanist for January, February of 1977. This statement affirming evolution was signed by prominent humanist scientists, including Corliss Lamont, and circulated to all the major school districts in the United States with a desperate plea, please not to allow anybody to teach this terrible unscientific creation concept and trying to prop up the fading stocks of evolution. Now, the reason I'm going into that is only to show that what we are facing in the claims of scientific humanism in the guise of science is in fact an antiquated, tottering and false, empirically false worldview which masquerades as science but is not. The real nature of the thing is religion, and even Mears in his History of European Thought in the 19th Century points out that the real appeal of Darwinism in Western Europe in the last century was that it finally liberated the tortured intellect from the necessity of having to assume a God. And Darwin was hailed so readily because he seemed to make unnecessary the assumption that there was a creative intelligence behind the universe. So Darwin's significance is basically philosophical and religious, not primarily scientific at all. Scientifically, his actual views are quite ridiculous today. So, in view of this fact, that we're facing, in the name of reason and in the name of science, a tremendous religious invasion, we are faced, I believe, in this country at least, with an essentially new situation for which the churches may not be prepared. In the past, it could be easily assumed, well, the law can be neutral with regard to the different churches, because finally all churches agree on the basic natural law. As long as everybody agrees that there is a God and to basic natural law, then we can get on with the business of basic public decencies, and then the state can be quite neutral with respect to different positive religions. But now something new has happened. The battle today is not between Roman Catholicism or Protestantism, and say possibly even Judaism or Mohammedanism. It's not today a great cultural battle for the minds of people by different positive religions, all of whom in principle acknowledge that there is a God. Today the totally new situation has arisen, that the basic cultural conflict in our civilization is fundamentally religious in this sense, that the basic confrontation is between those who believe there is a God and those who believe there is not, and who hate the whole idea of God and are determined to exterminate that idea from the minds and consciousness of men, and especially of the rising generation in the school. That is a new situation. I doubt that the civil powers can ultimately remain neutral in that conflict, because whoever wins that one, it will mean finally either the preservation or the end of Western civilization. Because if there is no God, then there is no logical reason for any kind of civilized behavior whatsoever. This is largely coming to be recognized even today. For example, a film like Clockwork Orange portrays a perfectly logical behavior if there is no God. Antonioni's film Blow Up was advertised in the London Underground, which is not a political movement but a train, advertised there, murder without guilt, love without meaning. If there is no God, then there can be no such thing as any kind of absolute objective norms of right and wrong. Then there can be no natural law at all. Then all matters of good and evil are purely matters of taste. Some people like Brussels sprouts and others don't. So some people enjoy adultery and others don't. And so let each do according to his taste. That then is the logical public philosophy. Now it's true. Most people will still have an emotional aversion to mass murder. Most of us, even if we believe there is no God, would still not go about machine gunning everybody in sight. But even if 51% of the population wouldn't be emotionally inclined that way, what about the other 49? What if there's only 10% who enjoy machine gunning? What if only 5 or 1%? Well, it takes a very small percentage of unhinged human beings to make life quite unlivable for the very large 99% of the rest. From a secular humanist point of view, there is no logical answer, for example, why Hitler should not have killed 6 million Jews if that happened to entertain or please him. What logical reason is that? None at all. If there is no God, then as Dostoevsky saw, then anything is permissible and possible. That's the kind of public thinking that we're in store for if this philosophy is allowed to virtually be ruled into public law, as we're in great danger of having it happen. So what is in effect happening is that this religion has completely tried to drive out any sense of public decency, has driven out the natural knowledge of God, the natural religion, out of the public realm and into the churches. And this is now a point I want to make yet in conclusion. That whereas we tend to think that the battle is this, that, well, all right, so we've given up on natural religion, but now we all just cling to our positive divine revelation and revealed religion. That's not so. The same secular humanist forces which have driven the natural law out of the public realm and are doing so, have also, to a large extent, driven revealed religion out of the church. The odd thing that's happened is that whereas the public sphere ought to be governed by natural law, natural religion, that is now being driven out by humanist irrationality. And whereas the churches ought to be governed by revealed religion, in fact, the churches today are governed basically by natural religion. In the written version of these sermonic comments, I'll give you all the documentation and so on. Suffice it here, so as not to waste too much time, simply to refer to this. When you read, for example, in a recent significant statement by the religion editor of the Los Angeles Times, that for most religious leaders today, Jesus is not God nor Savior, literally, and did not bodily rise from the dead, nor was he virgin born. What does that mean if that is true? And I have no reason to doubt it. If that is true, and if with a historical critical approach to the Bible, this is the point of view which largely dominates the fashionable seminaries and universities, then what is that but purely natural religion in the guise of Christianity? That's no longer revealed religion at all. These people don't believe in any revelation. They're simply taking the religion of natural human reason, dressing it up with a few Christian phrases, and palming that off on the public as being Christianity. And this has, of course, eaten its way also into Lutheran circles. I have here quotations, for example, again from Bratton's book and this Emerging Church book, the study of the view of the churches in Lutheran churches in America. Now, here are some of the statements. To be sure, that word is always becoming enfleshed in the concreteness of personal and communal history. It is neither culturally limited to Bethlehem nor historically limited to Good Friday. It is an eschatological word for all places and seasons, and the idolatry that absolutized past expressions of the reception of that word must give way. Nor is the church the exclusive agency of redemption in the world. That is amply demonstrated by the wider history of human communities, which shows the capability of secular movements to effect liberation. So anything that politically liberates is redemption, and Christ is merely a kind of cipher, and Mao Zedong can do just as well. This is no longer revealed religion at all. This kind of thing is purely natural religion. There's an interesting reference in, I believe it is Article 2 of the Formula of Concord, where it talks about natural reason's attitude to religion. And it says natural reason reduces religion simply to fable, the Bible to fables, and believes merely basic logical truth. And that's exactly what these people are doing. That recent British bombshell book, The Myth of God Incarnate, simply brings to the surface what really people have known for a long time, that leading spirits do not accept divine revelation at all, but are merely palming off a natural, purely natural product, natural religion, as if it were revealed religion. So we've had a great shift of natural religion from the public realm into the church realm, with the danger of revealed religion being squeezed out altogether. I see that my time is basically up, so I simply promise to give you the rest of the thing and the exact documentation in the written version that is to appear sooner or later. But the whole thing closes with the recommendation that what the church and what Christians can do is something very positive. The church as church, first of all, needs to take up its first task, and that is the proclamation of God's will. Law for the sake of the knowledge of sin, and then the gospel, which is the opus, the proprium, the real work of God for the sake of which everything else in the church happens. The church needs to proclaim and to believe and to confess the revealed truth of God in Jesus Christ, and to transmit the divine life in the gospel and sacraments, which alone can convey it. If the church will do that, then she'll also create people who have a bit of backbone. The terrible thing that's happening in modern education is that we're breeding a breed of people who, with the so-called value-free education, have no ultimate commitment to anything. This quote is too good to overlook. A recent statement by Professor Harry Messel, head of the university's School of Physics and director of the Science Foundation for Physics in the University of Sydney, And he said this: Australia must now seriously question whether it should continue to spend a couple of $1,000,000,000 a year on an education system which appears to be turning out an increasing number of undisciplined, irresponsible, greedy, often nearly illiterate, lawless individuals who don't give a tinker's damn for the country, their mates, or anybody else. It's the big me complex. Value-free education. So, if the church will again create Christians, people who have ultimate anchors, ultimate loyalties, ultimate commitments, who know themselves as fallen creatures before God, but redeemed in Jesus Christ, who have anchors, who have a rock of ages on which to stand, then also, God willing, there will be a supply of people who will be able to enter the public arena with some kind of guts and backbone, who will be able to reverse the terrible tide of barbarism in the civic sphere and reassert the some way the natural law. And so therefore, in that sphere, I suggest that only our good old two-nature doctrine, two-realm doctrine, can liberate people, Christians, from obfuscating ideologies and can show them that there is a way, namely what we might call not secular ecumenism, but civic ecumenism. Christians of all different kinds acting together in the civic sphere for basic human livableness. In school, publicly, the protection of children from pornography and that kind of thing. And in closing, I want to say one last thing. Bishop Otto Debelius of Berlin dropped a bombshell when, after decades of increasingly frustrating negotiating with the communists who wouldn't finally allow him to carry on basic pastoral function, Debelius dropped a bombshell when he wrote in a letter to Bishop Lilya that he can no longer believe that communist authorities are at all a lawful government. He says, they do not qualify as a lawful government under Romans 13. I owe them no obedience whatsoever. I don't even owe obedience morally to the traffic laws, because demons never become lawful powers, but remain always demons. He was tremendously criticized for that, as that being terribly un-Lutheran. I want to suggest only, let's not be too quick to jump to conclusions. Luther, while he strongly defended obedience and loyalty to lawful governments, to governments as governments, there was one strong exception. When the papacy, he says, when that wishes to rule through kings and princes, then you resist, and you resist that unto blood, even if it uses kings and princes, because God never gave the papacy the right to rule anybody. This is not a lawful power, but it is a vampire, a werewolf, and anybody can kill that werewolf on sight. It has no lawful standing before God or man at all. I suggest that if that is true of the medieval attempts of the papacy to rule the world, it is infinitely more true of the Communist Party. Who gave it any right to rule anybody? Obedience to the state, yes. But when the state becomes merely the instrument of a lawless, power-hungry political party that seeks to inoculate everyone with atheism and hatred, then we are in the presence of a terrible vampire and a werewolf which has no claim on our civic obedience whatsoever, but which Christians, as they have opportunity, ought to do their best to eradicate from the face of this earth. Thank you very much.